Teddy Epstein, Reel 12.
The other thing that I found out at this conference is that in England there are records of each individual child who was on a children's transport. The records are not complete. Because apparently some of them were lost. They were found in someone's garage in a cardboard box or several cardboard boxes. And I was given an address, and I wrote to them just recently. At this point, I've not yet heard, and I hope that my file is there, because I have a lot of questions that I'm not sure whether there will be answers to those questions in the file. But it's a little, another little piece of my life, and I think I've said this in previous tapes, that I sort of feel my life is like a big jigsaw puzzle. And I've found a number of pieces, but there are many missing. And maybe this will be one infinitesimally small piece. One of the things that I found out at the conference, but it raised a whole lot of other questions, and unfortunately not while I was there, because I think there was so much material coming in that I couldn't, I just let it, I was like a sponge, let it come in, but I didn't think critically or didn't, so, but now I have a lot of questions and I'm not sure that I'll ever find the answers to those questions. I learned at the conference that England has a tradition of saving children, which is something that I didn't know, and that, knowing that, that should help to change my image of England. I think that plays a very vital part, because I'm happy to hear that. I wish other countries, including the United States, would have that kind of a philosophy, and the United States does not and did not. Because while England accepted 10,000 of us, almost 10,000 of us children who came in on these children's transports, I believe the United States only permitted 200 children to come in, which is, the United States should be ashamed of it. But President Roosevelt and some of his colleagues felt that if more children were to come here, it could lead to anti-Semitism. And those 200 children came outside of the regular quota. But to come back to England, I understand that prior to Christmas night, to November 10th, 1938, there was discussion in Parliament about the rescue of children from Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. And then after Kristallnacht on November 21st, 1938, Sir Samuel Hoare, who was a foreign minister, I believe, at the time, gave a very impassioned speech in Parliament. And it was then decided that England would let 10,000 undocumented, or no, what is the term?
So unguaranteed.
Unguaranteed, thank you. Unguaranteed children to England and an unlimited number of guaranteed children. And the first transport, the children's transport, arrived in England on December 2nd, which is just less than 2 weeks after the decision was made in Parliament. That transport consisted of 196 children from Berlin. They were orphans, and their orphanage was firebombed during Kristallnacht. The very last transport, or known transport, arrived after the war had already started. On the day, it left Holland on the day that Holland fell, in April of 1940, and was bombed or strafed by the Nazis while these children were on the boat. It's believed that about or just under 10,000 children came to England. The guaranteed children, their guarantee was 50 pounds, English pounds, that were deposited somewhere. I don't know where. That's one of my questions. And that money was to be used later on when these children would be repatriated after it was safe for them to return. My question, one of the other questions that I have is, you know, not only where was the money deposited, but whose money was it, who gave the money, and since the children were not really repatriated after the war, what happened to the money? Not that I think I must have been one of the guaranteed children. Not that I want that money. I mean, that money is whatever use. I'm sure it was used well. But I'm just curious. And I guess the other thing I want to know is the other end. Well, how did it happen in Germany? What organization and what did they do and how did they work with the British government or British organizations, Jewish organizations, Christian organizations, Quakers?
Do you think you're, in the light of the organization which has now been formed, the Kinder Transport Association, that, you know, do you have hopes that somehow by having a group of people sort of debating and asking these questions, that these answers might come? There's more hope of that.
It's very possible. Another woman that I met at the conference is, and I just happened to be sitting next to her, and I didn't know it at the time because, again, she is a lot like Mr. Winton, a very modest person. It was only at the very end of the conference, and just before she had to leave in a hurry to catch a plane, she was one of the speakers, and she was introduced as a historian. And she works in, she's a historian, and she's associated with Princeton University. And she was apparently in England just before Ms. Burkholz died and interviewed her. And so she had lots of information that she has not yet totally digested or put in any kind of order, but she plans to publish that material. And I've been thinking of contacting her with my specific questions. Especially when I was sitting next to her and we were sort of chit-chatting, I handed her some of my literature that I used when I tried to get speaking engagements. So I, that way she will know, maybe remember who I am because of the literature that I gave her. And I intend to contact her and ask her some of the questions that I have. And if and when she comes across information that might answer my questions, maybe she can let me know.
Is it important for you, Hedy, to belong to that association, to have such an association?
It wasn't that important to me because I'd known about it, but I just didn't take the time. But now it has taken some importance for me. It's not the most important thing in my life, but it does play an important role. And I've gleaned a lot of information that I didn't have before. One of the purposes of the organization is to give us kinder an opportunity to talk to each other, to be supportive of each other, and to help each other when we maybe go out and speak. And I've gotten some of that material, and that material really hasn't been of any particular help to me. I've looked at it, and I'm glad to have it. But I've done some of those things, and some of those things I wouldn't do. But it's just, if there's another conference at another time, I think I will go again, if it's possible for me to go. Because maybe I will meet some people, other people, and hear their stories and see what they have done for themselves. And, there's places like, it's also what I can do for someone else.
Is that the main aim, do you think, to put people in touch with each other?
Right, Right. And also, one of the other goals of the organization is, because we were helped, we were saved, is to be aware of what is going on in the world, especially the other children, and to become involved in helping those children. And that, I think, is a really valuable and honorable thing to do. I mean, it's something that when I give my presentations, I tell, especially when I talk to younger people, I always tell them that you know, each and every one of us not only can, but must make a difference. And no one is too insignificant to do something to make this a better world for everyone and for each of us, for ourselves. And so I'm glad that the organization is not just inward looking, but also, yes, they're doing that, but they're also looking outside and seeing there is a need out there and there are little things that we can do to maybe ameliorate some of those needs and those pains.
Could I ask you now about the interview you were asked to do for Steven Spielberg?
Yes. I was contacted about 2 or 3 weeks ago by a representative of the Shoah Foundation in Chicago and asked if I would be willing to consent to an interview. I had quite some time ago got sort of a form letter, and I don't remember what the actual detailed content was. And it was, I probably was from the Shoah Foundation. I knew it had to do with Spielberg's project of interviewing Holocaust survivors. And I responded to it that I was interested. And so I guess this phone call that I got was maybe a follow-up to that. And I was interviewed on December 7th, 1995, in my home. There were 2 audio video videographers there, and a person who was interviewing me. The person who interviewed me is Julie Heifetz. She's from St. Louis, and several years ago she did the oral history interview of me for the local Holocaust Museum. I was asked by the person who contacted me from Chicago whether that would present a problem because I know Julie. And I said, no, it was not for me. And Julie, in turn, was asked whether it would present a problem for her because she would have to interview me as though she had never met me before. And she felt she could put all of that aside. In the course of the interview, she asked me some questions which was helpful to me that she did, because she knew what else I wanted to say, and she was able to steer me in that direction and get me off what I was talking about at that point, that I could have gone on probably for another hour, but it wasn't necessary to do that. So in a way, maybe it was good that she knew my story. I was amazed at the sensitivity of the videographer. For instance, when I opened the door, the first thing that happened, a cloth was spread out on the floor for them to walk on so it's not too dirty my house. I knew ahead of time that they were going to have to move some furniture around in order to get their equipment in and to set it up the way that they wanted to, but again, they asked for permission to do so. It just, you know, there was so much care and concern for my well-being that I ended up saying to them, you know, this is your house and I'm a guest in your house. And do whatever you want to do and what you need to do. You be comfortable. Mm-hmm.
Did you find the camera intrusive?
No. But that's perhaps because I very often in the past have been in front of the camera, and it doesn't faze me, it doesn't bother me. I mean, frequently when I give talks, it's taped, videotaped. I've been on radio and TV, and I've spoken publicly, and so none of that bothers me anymore. So the thing that amazed me is there were lights everywhere, huge lights, and I thought they would give off a tremendous amount of heat. And I was even thinking I might at some point have to change clothes because of them, and there was absolutely no heat from those lights. Which helps making you feel more comfortable, mm-hmm. because when those lights give, the glare was not bothering me, and but the heat could be very bad, and there wasn't any heat. Mm-hmm.
Have you any idea what the purpose of these videos are? You know, what he has in mind?
I understand this is a 3-year project, and he hopes to interview 50,000 Holocaust survivors all over the world. What surprises me is that there's still that many alive. I understand that by the end of October 1995, he interviewed almost 7,000 people the world over. And he's been in Russia and Australia and different places in Europe, and of course the United States and Canada, South America, and he will make it available for archival purposes in libraries all over the world, but he'll also put it on computer, on CD-ROM, in any future media that we don't even know yet what that might be. So it will be there for perpetuity, forever and ever. And some of it may be used as is, the entire story, then maybe may use it as excerpts of certain stories, may use it in conjunction with something else. For instance, if a particular place is mentioned, like let's say the concentration camp Auschwitz, he may insert archival photographs to illustrate what this is all about. The way it was done is the camera never moved. And the reason for that, I was told, is that if the camera were to pan or to come in closer and then go further back, that could be construed as being editorial. And he wants to be totally neutral, just that person's story. And there were, I had documents and photographs that they were interested in, but they were not used while I was speaking or while I was being interviewed. They were used at the end, photographs, or they were videotaped, or whatever you call that. I was asked to explain what it is. For instance, when there was a family group photograph, the whole photograph was shown, and then the camera zeroed in on each individual person, and I said, this is my father, and this is my cousin, so-and-so, and this is my grandmother, and so on and so forth.
Did that come out of Schindler's List, do you think?
I believe that idea. It did. I believe it did. And he felt that he had, or this is what I was told, that he felt he had not done anything of great value up to that time. And I think he sort of discovered his Judaism or his Jewish connection, and felt that this was a project of great importance that he needed to do. I just learned last night from another filmmaker that Spielberg has contributed $6 million of his own money to this. I find that kind of interesting, the figure of $6 million. I don't know if that just is accidental or whether it's purposely, because one says that 6 million Jews lost their lives. He apparently, this is again what the filmmaker told me last night, that he finds it difficult to go to events which are really fundraisers for him to raise money for his project. But he's learned, as this filmmakers is, learning what a lot of us have been doing for a long time and why we sometimes have to stop doing our projects in the middle because we have no more money to go on. Which apparently is something, a new experience for Spielberg. He's always had the funds to do what he wanted to do.
There's also, of course, the Washington Holocaust Museum. Has that any significance for you? I know you have been there,
yes,
haven't you?
Yes, I was there, and I spent 2 days at the museum, but I did not see everything, because I spent a good part of the second day in their archives. And I asked specifically, do you have material about contiguous, camps where my parents had been, about Blondie and so on. And they, I was given photo albums of contiguous. And I went through it fairly quickly, actually, because I knew I wanted to see so much. And and in some ways, I think I was hoping that I would find some photographs of family members, especially my parents. But then when I came across two photographs of my grandmother, my father's mother, I was kind of shocked and taken back because there were so many people there, and I don't know how these photographs were taken, nor do I know how the museum received them. There was no source given. And I asked them about it, and I said, you know, as a museum, you really need to put them in, even if you don't know exactly, but somebody had to bring them to you. You should have asked, who are you and where did you get them from? And I asked them if they would identify my grandmother by name and whatever information I had about her. And in my presence, they did so. And also put down my name and where I can be reached. And I asked them to make copies of those photographs, and they did. They made big, blown-up photographs of me. While I was there, I also gave them photographs that I have that were taken in Nuremberg at the trial of the doctors who performed medical experiments, and some other photographs that I have of some of the other trials. And I said, you know, be sure to put down what it is and where it came from. And they obviously did that because earlier this year I was contacted by a professor at Boston University who hopes or plans to have a 50th anniversary event in December 1996, 50th anniversary of the beginning of the medical trial. And I asked him, how did you get my name? And he said, you gave photographs to the museum in Washington, D.C., and I saw them, and you gave them photographs that I've never seen anywhere before. And your name, you know, is given as a source, and that's why I contacted you. So maybe I have had some small influence there for the museum. In March of 1996, I plan to go back to the museum. Excuse me. Because at that time, in March 1996, there will be a Nuremberg reunion. And I plan to attend that. And then when that is over, I plan to spend a day or so at the museum and to see those things that I haven't seen yet. And maybe if there's time, go back in the archives again.
But when we have our genocide museum, as it will be called, you must certainly come over, Hedy.
Yes,
and thank you so much.
When do you think you can have that?
Oh, it will be I hope not too long, but probably a couple of years. But thank you very much again, Hedy, for topping up your interview from 18 months ago. It's been very interesting.
Thank you very much for your continued interest and your sensitivity and your love.
Thank you, Hedy.
And have a good trip back to Jolly Old.